mit Sibylle Salewski. Heute Creative Commons und Innovation von Lawrence Lessig. Lawrence Lessig ist Juraprofessor an der Harvard-Universität. Sein Spezialgebiet, das Urheberrecht im Internet. Vor 10 Jahren entwickelte Lawrence Lessig ein neues, weniger restriktives Urheberrecht, Creative Commons, kurz CC. Creative Commons, das heißt so viel wie kreatives Allgemeingut, und genau darum geht es. Künstler, Wissenschaftler, Medienschaffende und andere Kreative sollen durch Creative Commons die Möglichkeit haben, ihre Inhalte zur Weiterverarbeitung oder auch zur Weiterverbreitung freizugeben, ohne dass sie dadurch automatisch all ihre Urheberrechte aufgeben. Creative Commons Lizenzen werden mittlerweile nicht nur in den USA, sondern auch in vielen anderen Ländern, darunter Deutschland, Brasilien und Korea, verwendet. In seinem Vortrag berichtet Lawrence Lessig von der Entstehungsgeschichte von Creative Commons und diskutiert die Frage, wie viel Freiheit im Internet nötig ist für das Weiterentwickeln und Erblühen kreativer Inhalte. Immer mehr Unternehmen, Facebook zum Beispiel oder Apples iPad und iPhone, arbeiten mit geschlossenen Plattformen, die unter der alleinigen Kontrolle dieser Firmen stehen. Diese Entwicklung, so Lessig, sei noch vor 5 Jahren kaum denkbar gewesen. Seinen Vortrag hat Lessig am 4. Juni 2010 beim Creative Commons Kongress in Seoul in Südkorea gehalten. Hören Sie nun Creative Commons und Innovation von Lawrence Lessig.
So as I come here to watch this conference 5 years after the launch of Creative Commons Korea, I feel a little bit like an old man. And I begin to reflect on the fact that I've actually produced in my life a number of kids, and Creative Commons is actually the very first of the children which I helped father. But just the first. This was my second, a boy named Willem. And the fact is that for the first 5 years of Creative Commons life and Willem's life, I shamelessly exploited Willem to support Creative Commons. I exploited him first by spending literally probably 2 years of his first 5 years on the road promoting Creative Commons, thus meaning I could only ever interact with him through my laptop computer, as I did across the world as I traveled. And that exploitation produced an organization, Creative Commons, which I have enormous pride in. And that pride continues. Even though 3 years ago this month, I announced in Dubrovnik at our conference that I personally would be moving on from the project of Creative Commons as my central focus, to focus on an even more difficult, more impossible problem, the problem of corruption in government. I've been extraordinarily proud to see the gains that Creative Commons has made since then. As Joey described this morning, just last year, Creative Commons could announce Al Jazeera as a new partner, the White House as a new partner, Wikipedia as a new partner. And according to Mike Linksfair, working with all of the numbers, we were able to announce a growth in the total licensed objects of Creative Commons to now be close to 350 million objects. But if this movement is a sibling of our family, there's a certain competition among siblings. That competition can be fierce. My personal family has now grown, and the question for Creative Commons is how it will grow in that as well. What's next for Creative Commons? And in answering that question, I have to confess a certain amount of anxiety. An anxiety about where next, or more precisely, what next for this movement. For as Creative Commons has grown, the world around Creative Commons has changed. And this culture has changed, changing what success is possible. A change that I think raises a doubt about how important open still is. So when you look at this anxiety and we think about the source, well, actually, we could just reveal the source of this anxiety here by view source. I think that there's a parallel anxiety that's happening in the ecology of the net between both the place of freedom or openness in the world of platforms and in the space of culture. So let me talk about that. This concept of openness I want to talk about in these two places: platforms for innovation and culture. And the question I want to ask is there evidence that openness is needed? And in the context of platforms, we can begin to answer that question by thinking about three stages in the development of internet platforms. And by stages, I mean differences in the reality of how open those platforms were. Where, by open, what I mean is not whether they're proprietary or not. What I mean instead by open is whether there is effective control of the platform. If there's no control, if the platform doesn't try to control what gets built on top of it, then that platform's open. But if there is control, then the platform is not open. So here's the story. It goes like this. Once upon a time, we had stage one in this evolution. And in stage one, there was a company. Many of you might not have realized the significance of this company, but it was a company called Microsoft. And many of you don't know this, but circa 1996, Microsoft was one of the sexiest companies in the world to work with. Hard to believe today, but that's what that company was in 1996. It had the greatest engineers, it had the greatest excitement, the greatest charge, because it was building a dominant platform, even though a proprietary platform, upon which most of the computing activity around the world was being built. Now, in the sense in which I describe the word open, that platform originally was open. There was no proven effort by that platform to control what stuff ran on top of it. If you wrote a program, it ran on the Windows operating system, if you followed the rules of the operating system. And nothing in the operating system, and certainly nothing in the license that gave you the right to run the operating system, gave Microsoft the right to control whether your program could run. The idea that when you wrote a program and ran it on your computer, Microsoft would be able to say, "We don't like that program, remove it," was crazy. Nobody suggested that Microsoft had that power. But then things changed a bit. And the most dramatic statement of that change came in a federal lawsuit filed against Microsoft by the Department of Justice. And in that lawsuit, the claim was that Microsoft was exercising control over the platform to protect the platform against competition. And the precise claim was that Microsoft was trying to kill the emerging Netscape browser, which at the time was by far the dominant browser in the market, because it expected that the Netscape browser plus the Java, what they thought of as eventual operating system, would be a competition to the dominance of the Windows operating system. And so they used their power in the Windows operating system to create a browser that would muck up this strategy of a competing operating system. So for the first time, the claim was, in a powerful way, using their monopoly to protect the monopoly in the operating system. And as the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit concluded unanimously, the government proved their case. Microsoft had violated the antitrust laws by protecting itself in this particular way. And this cool company became an uncool company. The perception was of Microsoft trying to exercise control, and in this period, control became uncool. Non-control, freedom, became the cool word of the time. Now, the key here to recognize is that what this change is describing is an emerging culture, a culture of openness. And the central value of this culture was that no big or bad company or government should be controlling where I go or what I run when I run my computer on the internet. That's what freedom means. And what that culture then did is develops the second stage in this evolution of openness in the platforms. The rise of, or some suggested, the return to open platforms. And a wide range of companies and movements began to build an internet that was based upon effectively open platforms. Some of these platforms you could not control legally because the platforms were non-proprietary free software platforms. So the GNU Linux operating system, what eventually became the Firefox browser, the Apache web server, these were all parts of the internet platform that no one could legally control to block the use of that technology for any particular purpose. So platform at the code layer of the internet. And some of these emerging open platforms simply did not control what people did in a way that interfered with this basic value of openness. And I want to suggest Google at the content layer was that. Google was born with a certain ethic that the search results that should win were the results that, in some sense, on the merits, ought to win. They were distinct in the search engine market by not selling to the highest bidder the top results on a search page, but instead returning searches quickly and directly that gave the user exactly what the user wanted and let the user get out as quickly as they wanted. And as many books recounting the development of Google described, that was because they believed in a certain ethic. And the ethic was, if you were coding to give you something that the choice of users wouldn't directly give you, that was uncool. Google reacted by building something cool. Give people simply what they want. That, again, was an ethic. And that ethic, plus the ethic of other companies in this space, produced lots of alternatives, lots of innovations. And it gave birth to what we can think of as internet innovation theory. I penned something about this in this book, The Future of Ideas, but the essence and the claim of internet innovation theory is that innovation on the internet was a function of its openness. Again, where open meant that no one would control the platform, that meant that no one developing for that platform need to fear that the platform would turn against it. Netscape had learned that it should fear the Windows operating system because it turned against Netscape, but openness in this context meant that no platform would turn against what you developed on top of it. It increased your trust then in the platform, and trust decreased risk, and decreased risks meant increased return to innovators and investors. And so the theory was, If the platform was controllable, there would be less innovation. If it was not controllable, there would be more innovation. But that gets us then to stage three, where I think we are now. The emergence of these controllable and controlled platforms of innovation. Yet platforms that have produced an extraordinary range of innovation. So think about Facebook or Twitter or the emerging iPad. Each of these are platforms in the sense that people innovate and develop applications on top of them. But these platforms live by a different ethic, different set of rules. They give us what we want, great functionality, but we don't get freedom or a guarantee of openness in these platforms. Innovation is owned on top of these platforms. Even though the platform reserves the right to control that innovation, the puzzling thing for innovation theory is we see tons of innovation here. So, for example, look at the Facebook platform. It's the terms of service of the Facebook platform. These are terms of service for innovators who are developing applications that run on top of this platform. Facebook has the right at any time, in its sole discretion, and immediately upon notice, to terminate the foregoing licenses and any other license granted, and requires that you delete any Facebook properties and all materials containing any Facebook properties that are in your possession or control, and you will promptly comply with such a request. We reserve the right to charge a fee for using Facebook or any features at any time at our sole discretion. If we do charge a fee, you don't have an obligation to continue to use Facebook. But if you do, we'll specify how the fee gets calculated, the terms on which you'll be invoiced and the charge, and the terms of payment. Now, the point I want you to think about is, imagine Microsoft in 1998 had these as the terms of service for the Windows operating system. Imagine Microsoft had said, at any time, we have the right to tell you, you can't run your program on our operating system. You, Netscape, can't run your browser on our operating system. Or if they had said, we have the right at any time to tell you how much it will cost you to run your program on our operating system. So if Netscape becomes popular, we're going to charge them $10 million to run their program on our operating system. If Microsoft had done that in 1998, people would have been outraged, astonished. And yet I doubt many of you even recognized that Facebook had these terms of service built into their platform today. Or think more famously about the iPhone platform. The iPhone, when Steve Jobs introduced it, was described this way. He said, we define everything that is on the phone. You don't want your phone to be like a PC. The last thing you want is to have it loaded three apps on your phone, and then you go to make a call and it doesn't work anymore. Now, that was the justification Steve Jobs gave for a wide set of restrictions about what programs were allowed to run on the iPhone. And all programs to run on the iPhone would have to pass through an application store that Apple would control. And to be able to submit programs to the application store, users or developers had to sign a developer's agreement. And as EFF has typically brilliantly described, that developer's agreement basically means, as they put it, quote, all your apps belong to Apple, the iPhone Developer Program License Agreement, meaning you, the innovator, have effectively turned over control of your innovation to Apple. And so, as they've summarized the terms of this agreement, you, first of all, are not, as a developer, allowed to make public statements about the agreement. You can't even describe what's in the agreement. Number two, you are forbidden from tinkering with any Apple product. So you're not allowed to unlock your iPhone or iPad or even try to without violating your agreement. You're not allowed to reverse engineer the iPhone. Even if fair use law would protect that, you're promising you won't reverse engineer. You will only sell your innovation through the App Store. So that means if you use Apple's suite of programs to develop an application, an iPhone and the App Store does not accept it, then you're not even allowed to use your program on a different platform. You have to throw it away. You've lost that innovation. Apple has the right to kill the application at any time, and indeed there's a suggestion that there is code built into your iPhone, so if Steve Jobs wants to turn off a program, they can flip a switch and the program disappears off people's iPhones even after they've installed it. And whatever Apple does, the most that they owe a developer is $50. So a developer could spend hundreds of thousands of dollars developing an iPhone application, deploy it on the iPhone. Steve Jobs pulls it off the iPhone. The most Apple owes the developer is $50. Now, my point is that this is a platform like the Facebook platform, like the Twitter platform, that are controlled and controllable. And yet the puzzle is innovation flourishes. And that's leading to a need to adjust this innovation theory, because obviously the mere means to control don't seem to be enough to stifle innovation. And the open question, or the question about openness, is whether it will stifle innovation in the future. Indeed, if the means and the motive for stifling innovation develop, will innovation slow? So again, think about in the context of Apple and its iPhone and its new iPad. The iPad, of course, is somewhere between the phone and the PC, both in size and in applications. And once again, on the iPad, Apple has exercised control. Control has been exercised to say what applications get to run on the iPad. So even though the iPad looks like a small version of the PC, you're not allowed to load programs onto that PC except according to the terms that Apple has set. So what that means is important platforms like Flash are slowly being pushed into the graveyard as Apple decides Flash shall no longer exist. Or increasingly, iPhone, iPad developers are finding their programs removed for reasons that are, in many people view, completely arbitrary. There's a recent brouhaha about this program, My Frame, which gives you the ability to select photos on your iPad or your iPhone and then put things on top of it, for example, the time or the temperature or weather reports. This program has just last week been removed by Apple. It was removed, and the developer, who had been a constant defender of Steve Jobs and the iPhone and the iPad, wrote Steve Jobs an email. He said, "Hi, Steve. Just got a call from Apple letting us know that our iPad app, MyFrame, is being removed from the store. Apparently, Apple is cracking down on, quote, widgety-type apps. Our app is a beautiful photo frame with a few nice things you can put over your photo. It's not ugly or even widgety. I don't know what that word means, but what gives? I've always defended you guys in the past, but it seems like you've crossed an invisible line. Even the guys on the phone was saying how much he liked our application, but there's nothing he could do." Steve Jobs responded to this email. He responded, "We are not allowing apps that create their own desktops. Sorry, sent from my iPad." But look at the word, allowing? They're not allowing certain applications like this? The point is, this is a totally alien ethic to the ethic of the internet and development and innovation that existed just 5 years ago. You might look at this and say, this is just Apple or this is Steve Jobs. And there's some support for that. I mean, think, for example, about this episode around Gizmodo's review of the next version of the iPhone, which was supported by an iPhone that had been illegally given to someone who turned it over to Gizmodo. After this happened, Apple aggressively sought to recover the phone and enlisted local police support to bash down the door of the Gizmodo site to discover any evidence they could find about who actually turned over the phone, leading the greatest critic, social commentary critic in the United States, John Stewart, to provide this commentary.
Apple, you guys are the rebels, man, the underdogs. People believed in you. But now, are you becoming the man? Remember back in 1984? You had those awesome ads about overthrowing Big Brother?
On January 24th, Apple computer will introduce Macintosh.
Look in the mirror, man! Or actually, just look into the screen of your iPad before you turn it on, because it is surprisingly reflective. It's really beautiful. You guys do this. It wasn't supposed to be this way. Microsoft was supposed to be the evil one. But now you guys are busting down doors in Palo Alto while Commandant Gates is ridding the world of mosquitoes. What the f*** is going on? It's all mixed up. I don't know which end is up anymore. Black and white cats or dogs. I know that it is slightly agitating that a blog dedicated to technology published all that stuff about your new phone. And you didn't order the police to bust down their doors, right? I'd been pissed too. He didn't have to go Minority Report on his ass. In fact, if you want to break down someone's door, why don't you start with AT&T? For God's sakes, they make your amazing phone unusable as a phone. I mean, seriously. How do you drop four calls in a 1 mile stretch of the West Side Highway? There's no building around. What does the open space confuse AT&T signal? Why don't you kick in Paul McCartney's door for not letting us buy Beatles songs on iTunes? And while you're at it, ask him about Ebony and Ivory. What the f*** was that? Come on, Steve. Just chill out with the paranoid corporate genius stuff. Don't go Howard Hughes on us. We don't want to picture you holed up in a tower somewhere peeing into mason jars while designing a giant wooden touchscreen that you'll use once.
It's the new iSpruce.
I'm telling you this because it's important, man. And believe me, I'm taking a big chance here. I mean, this is my audience. This is way more explosive than putting Muhammad in a bikini to my audience. So anyway, chill, babe. And you know that new iPhone with the front-facing camera and video chat? Could you send me one of those little girls? It looks totally sick.
Okay, now Steve Jobs was asked about this incident when they made a decision to aggressively go after the blogger who had reported about this new iPhone. As the newspaper reported, Jobs said he had received advice from many who had told him he should let it slide. And Jobs reflected as the story continues, I thought deeply about this. I ended up concluding that the worst thing that could possibly happen as we get big, now this is sounding a little bit optimistic, right? He's talking about get big, what should big people not do? And as we get a little more influence in the world, is if we change our core values and start letting it slide. I can't do that. I'd rather quit, Jobs said. And you say, the core values of the company are that they're going to aggressively threaten and punish people who publish information about the company that they can't perfectly control? There's something astonishing about this confession. Now, again, maybe it's just Jobs. Maybe it's just Apple. After all, here we are in the middle of the we generation. But look at the Apple suite of applications and innovations, the iPhone, the iPad, me.com. What is this iMe? This is not the iMe time. It's the we time. It's about sharing and building communities, not me sitting there showing myself my own pictures. But as I think about this more, maybe I need to say as we think about this more, I think it reflects actually a fundamental change in the ethics of this age, of this stage, of stage three. So three stages in the history of the development here. All three of these stages are generative in John Zittrain's sense of the word. But the open question, the question about openness, is what is the relationship between openness or control and innovation? Is the ethic of open, which only existed fully in stage two, actually necessary for innovation? And my anxiety is that maybe innovation doesn't need this openness. The question is free essential here? Now, the freedom optimists say, yes, freedom is essential. Fascism begets revolts. Remember, Microsoft used to be cool. And open, which is now, of course, alien, it's a kind of Android creature here, is what we now have as open in the iPhone-like market, will return, this optimist says. Maybe that's right. But remember, freedom's biggest evangelist here, a man named Richard Stallman, who publishes pictures like this of himself on the internet. Richard Stallman is not a freedom optimist. Richard Stallman is perfectly happy to confess that freedom might actually produce second-rate technology. And he's okay with that, because to him, freedom is more important than first-rate technologies. But I think the challenge for us today is to answer this question, whether openness is good, whether openness is essential, or whether freedom here is just a fad. One final exchange with Steve Jobs. A blogger wrote this to Steve Jobs after the iPad control was announced. He said, if Dylan, Bob Dylan, was 20 today, how would he feel about your company? Would he think the iPad had the faintest thing to do with revolution? Revolutions are about freedom. To which Jobs replied, yep, freedom from programs that steal your private data, freedom from programs that trash your battery, freedom from porn, yep, freedom. And then he had the gall to say, the times, they are a-changin', and some traditional PC folks feel like their world is slipping away. It is. The PC world is slipping away into a new revolutionary world where the Steve Jobs of the world decide which applications and which innovations should be allowed to you. That's the story of open platforms. I think there's a similar story to be told in the context of culture. Same anxiety. Now, of course, I think some of the issues in the context of culture and the context of content are easy. There still is low-hanging fruit here, lots of it. The context of government, the context of science, the context of education. These are plainly contexts within which the movement, which you guys are a part, to free content and to license it openly and freely is important and has lots of gains to be made. But in the core of culture, the struggle for culture's core in the context of copyright is even harder than it was in the context of code. For after all, software had cuddly creatures like this to rally around. Content had a more aggressive creature like Napster that never really got public support for the movement's ideals, never really a popular resonance with the idea of open or free culture, except the resonance that's been built around movements like ours in Creative Commons. It's not the same problem as it is with code. And our challenge is, how do we make it essential? How do we make freedom essential to people's conception of how culture should be produced? Well, I think the key to this is to begin by identifying where freedom, CC freedom here, is necessary. And we can see where CC freedom is necessary by looking at the economy of the creativity and the particular use of the content that is being made. So first think about these economies. Now, by economies, what I mean here is just practices of exchange. And I want to identify three practices of exchange. Some of these economies are economies where money is in the middle. Think of them as a commercial economy. This is what you do when you stand in a grocery store. You pay a certain amount of money to get a certain amount of bread. It's quid pro quo. This for that. And money in that type of economy is how we speak. But some economies don't have money in the middle of them. We could call them sharing economies. These are repeated exchanges that people have, but they don't have money mediating the exchange. So friendship among children, or friendship among adults, or friendship among lovers. These are all economies that exist, but they are economies that, for these, money is not how we speak. Indeed, if you introduced money into those economies, you would radically change what they were about. Imagine one person said, "Do you want to have lunch next week?" And the other person said, "Sure, if you give me $50. Or if you drop money into the middle of this kind of relationship, what you do is instantly turn it into that type of relationship. The point is, these economies exist and survive without money. Indeed, they depend upon money not being a part of them. And then three, there are some economies that have both a commercial and sharing component together. We can call these hybrid economies. Commercial economies that leverage a sharing economy, or sharing entities that leverage a commercial economy. So think about a bowling alley where people get together with their friends to bowl. There's obviously commerce involved. You have to pay the bowling alley to be able to bowl. But the bowling is not about the bowling. The bowling is about the friendship and the relationships that you have at the bowling alley. Or think about a bar. A bar is where friends get together and they talk. Of course, there's money involved as you pay for the stuff you are consuming, but the bar is not just about money. Money is there, but it's not just money. This is a hybrid economy. Now, the point is, in the internet, we have seen all three of these economies. We've seen a commercial economy and a sharing economy. Commercial economies like Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and eBay. Sharing economies like Wikipedia, SETI at Home, OpSound. These two economies have existed, but we've also, and importantly, seen hybrid economies develop. So, for example, think about Flickr, which, of course, is a commercial site that allows you to share photos, but the photos are shared expressly talking about how others are allowed to share them. This sharing, then, is at the core in the DNA of Flickr. But when Yahoo bought Flickr, it bought it because it expected to translate that sharing economy into profit for Yahoo. Or a site, Yelp, mainly right now in the United States, which allows you to rate sites and venues. Of course, what you're doing is sharing views. You're building communities around sharing these views, but the company, of course, hopes to make money out of that sharing. Or entities like Second Life, which encourage an enormous amount of energy by their community in building out these virtual communities. They build out these virtual communities, building these communities of innovation, but of course the objective is for companies like Linden Lab to make money from this. Now, once we see this mixture between commercial and sharing economies, I think you'll see it everywhere. Go back to Amazon. Is Amazon really just a commercial entity? Of course, it sells books, but it sells books in the particular way in which it does by building upon a community who shares reviews and ratings about the products that are being sold. It depends upon that community to make more money. Or think even about Microsoft. Microsoft runs user groups. Those user groups are monitored and managed by this technology in the research center that guides these groups to facilitate them to produce the best kind of input for free into the Microsoft user groups, thus leveraging these sharing communities into providing more profit for Microsoft. Indeed, at a conference that I was at, Steve Ballmer said last year, every successful internet business will be a hybrid. His conception is that the future is this future of hybrid economies. Now, the different economies here have different norms or ethics built within them. And those differences affect where free is going to matter. In the commercial economies, free matters less. In the sharing economies, free matters more. That's the story about economies. Now think a little bit about use. The question here is, what do you need to do with a particular kind of content? Do you want to remix it or just reuse it? And I've tried to characterize this distinction using computer terminology of read-only and read-write. Read-only content is content you merely intend to consume. Read-write is content you intend to consume and then remix or do something with and share with others. And of course, in the internet context, we've seen both of these. In the read-only context, there was Napster and then Apple and its iTunes music store allowing you to buy content which you can consume. But in the read-write context, we've seen an explosion of new innovation in read-write technology. First, in the context of individual creators, artists like Girl Talk, who can be remixing hundreds of different songs in a particular context of innovation, or communities that are increasingly developing a kind of call and response to their creativity, most directly described or manifested in contexts like YouTube. So think, for example, about this. Here's a YouTube video that I found.
Yo! Soulja Boy Tell. Hey, I got this new damn for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You just gotta point it and crank back three times from left to right. Soulja Boy, win it.
That video then inspired this video.
Soulja Boy Tell. Hey, I got this new dance for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You gotta punch then crank back three times from left to right.
And then that inspired this video.
Soulja Boy Tell. Hey, I got this new dance for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You gotta punch then crank back three times from left to right.
Or here's another more recent example. This song, it's a Brat Pack remix. Can you bring the lights down a bit so we can see this?
This song, video, lights down.
So sentimental, not sentimental, no romantic, not disgusting. It's down and out, down and only. Way more than fortunate, only.
Okay, so this was put out on the web, and it began to inspire these communities around the world to begin to make their own remixed versions of this. Just keep the lights down. So, this one's Brooklyn.
Thank you.
These are just volunteers, amateurs. These are not professionals. They've just put this together because they wanted to celebrate the same music. And then California thought that anything that Brooklyn can do, it could do better. There's been now an Amsterdam remix of the very same thing. And there's been a Winnipeg remix of the very same thing. So, but then this asks, what's going to be next? Who's going to be next? Obviously, I think the next city to do this remix should be a city inspired somewhere around here. Maybe Creative Commons Korea can be the next remix of this Listomania song. But the point to think about as you think about all of these different communities remixing and building upon the earlier creativity is why Sousa was wrong. So I've talked many times about John Philip Sousa at the beginning of the last century, complaining, as he testified to the Congress, that talking machines were going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country, as he put it. He said, when I was a boy, in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today, you find these infernal machines going night and day. He said, we will not have a vocal cord left. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. Now, this is the picture to focus on, young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. And what we've just seen in these different remixes of Listomania or the million other examples that we have seen in the context of YouTube is that we now have our vocal cords back. Technology has given them back. That's the good, optimistic side of the story. But here again, there's a taunting question. Is openness essential to this? It's an open question. If open means no control, or if open means the content is freely licensed, what we're seeing here are hybrids that are controlled. So YouTube doesn't enable the freely licensing of the content that gets remixed on YouTube. Facebook and Twitter don't yet provide free licensing of the content that they build communities on top of. They have produced effectively free environments to share and to remix, but not legally free environments to share or to remix. And there is lots of creativity without this legal guarantee of freedom. Now, the point here is that this openness or this free or CC-free ethic is still not integrated, still not at the core of many of the most important of the modern applications of creativity in the internet. And so this leads many of us to think, well, what could we do to make it so? How could we add it back into the core? And I think there are two important strategies here. Number one, there's a strategy of this preacher, strategy of someone who goes out and lectures trying to shame people into behaving in the appropriate way. And number two, there's the strategy of the candy manufacturer in candy stores. The strategy of making available what people want in an easy way for them to get it. In the internet culture, we talk about this as the cornucopia of the commons, a message which is you can always get people to do what they already want to do. And so we need to build and architect systems that get them to do for us stuff while they're doing for themselves what they already want to do. And the challenge is how we make what we think is essential, free culture, wanted in the context of this network. Now, I think the honest answer, at least the honest answer for me, is we don't know yet. As with open platforms, where they're technically free is making them technically free is not essential. There's nothing yet to show that with culture, open in culture is essential for this kind of innovation. And so what we need to do is to make it so. How could we do that? Well, this is where you come in. You can help in this process. You can help with this. You can help with this ecology. What part of this ecology can't we live with unless it is free? How can we make more of the ecology depend upon this freedom? Now, as I've looked at this, I think there are some best cases, best case examples. We can build commons collections. This is an example of the cornucopia of the commons type of instance. So think about Wikipedia. Wikipedia give people a purpose, a commons-related purpose, to write these articles that spread knowledge around the world, and they give them the means, the technical means, to serve it. So think about something like an iPhone app, a Feed the Commons app that made it easy for people to donate content to the commons, but then made it fun to rate the contents on the commons. You know, like taking your app and you see a photo and you flip it one way if you like it, and if you don't like it, you flip it the other way, and aggregate all of that flipping in a way that builds rankings of this content in a manner that begins to create a usable commons that others could build upon to take the creativity and do something interesting with it. Or the second solution is to make hybrids more political. This is the preacher solution. So hybrids, again, these sharing economies that have commercial entities leveraging them, they have an implicit social contract. That contract says, here's what's fair. And the communities and the commercial entities thrive so long as the fairness continues. But what we need here is activists to resist what we should think of as sharecropping economies, where the creators or the recreators do all the work, but the man owns all the rights. We need to resist that kind of hybrid. We need to insist on the rights of the remix creator, so that the creator becomes our ally in building a world where their control over their creativity is an essential part of how hybrids develop. And this is just two ideas to make free essential, but what we need is more of these ideas, thinking strategically about how we make what we are building and creating an essential part of the internet future. And that's the place for you. Let me just say one final reflection from me. So this day after my 49th birthday, feeling like the old man, confessing these anxieties about how we can assure that freedom is not a fad, and confessing more perilously, at least for an academic, that I honestly believe that we have no proof yet about how freedom is an essential part of this innovation environment. Even though we have no proof yet, I think what we should do is look around at people like the people here, people like the people who inspired this photograph, one of my favorite CC license photographs from here in Korea. Because as you see the kind of creativity that this community is inspiring, proof must be there if we can see it and describe it. So this old man is proud of what you've done to help make this possible, and grateful for what you've done for building it as successfully and extraordinarily inspiringly here in Korea. And I'm grateful and thankful to you for allowing me to participate in continuing this conversation. Thank you very much.
Der Rechtswissenschaftler Lawrence Lessig über die Frage, wie viel Freiheit das Internet benötigt, um Kreativität und Fortschritt zu ermöglichen. Lessig hielt seinen Vortrag am 4. Juni 2010 beim Creative Commons Kongress in Südkorea.